Hey everyone, if you love listening to Curbsiders and want to enhance the experience, then now is a great time to join the Curbsiders Patreon with new annual memberships where you can save 10% off the monthly rate. You'll have the option to hear all the episodes ad-free, plus twice monthly bonus episodes. You can sign up at patreon.com/curbsiders. This is a great way to use that CME money that's probably burning a hole in your pocket, plus support the show so we can keep bringing you clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, mini-series like Teach and Addiction Medicine, our Digest newsletter, and of course, expand our video content. So join the Cashlack family today at patreon.com/curbsiders.
The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only. The topics discussed should not be used to diagnose, treat, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the hosts and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity aside from possibly Cashlack Memorial Hospital. In short, we aren't responsible if you screw up. Please do your homework and let us know if we got something wrong.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders Addiction Medicine, our mini-series on substance use disorders. I'm Dr. Carolyn Chan, and tonight I'm joined by Dr. Sean Cohen. And in tonight's episode, we are so stoked because we are going to talk about injection jerk use-related infective endocarditis. And we have incredible guest, Dr. Aisha Appa. But before we get started with that, Sean, will you please just remind the audience, what do we do on this show?
I would love to, and I'm so excited to be back, although I don't actually know if this is the first episode airing, but we are the addiction med podcast that uses expert interviews to demystify common addiction med topics, reduce stigma, and inspire listeners to be fierce advocates for all individuals who use substances. And as a reminder, most episodes are available for free CME through VCU Health CE for all health professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account.
And a really special thanks to the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine, also known as ACAM. They partnered with us again, you know, to help support the Curbsiders Addiction Medicine series. ACAM is the proud home for academic addiction medicine faculty and trainees, and they were just absolutely dedicated to supporting the next generation of academic addiction medicine leaders. So learn more at their website, acam.org, and see, you know, and think about becoming a member.
Yeah, I am a member. I actually love ACAM. They have some great resources on there. So we have a hearty conversation with our guest. You didn't laugh, Carolyn.
Well,
maybe
Sean,
you're muted.
I you wish I was muted. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. That's
I think
very true.
We're going to have to work on this for the season.
Well, our guest, Dr. Aisha Appa, did laugh at my jokes. I don't think that's true either, but she loves bugs and drugs related to bugs. And she's a physician that's duly trained in infectious disease and addiction medicine, focused on creating effective patient-centered interventions pairing treatment of substance use disorders and HIV or other serious infections. She's currently faculty at UCSF, working at San Francisco General on both the ID and the Addiction Medicine Consult Service, as well as an HIV primary care provider. Could you think of a cooler mix of jobs? And she teaches us really about taking a patient-centered history of someone's drug use, particularly when they're presenting with these severe infections, can be a really iterative process where you're kind of focusing on getting the urgent things that are going to change management right now, getting those early, and then kind of slowly getting the rest of it when people are feeling better. That really effective care for these serious infections involves partnering with teams, multidisciplinary teams, and kind of teams from all walks of medicine, including CT surgery, social work, and things like that, to address all of someone's needs, particularly with endocarditis. She gives us a framework for how to think through facilitating the gold standard of infection treatment, not abandoning patients if they do to decide to leave prematurely, and really making sure we give them the treatment that they really need and connect them with resources. And so after that very long summary I just gave, I will get us to the episode. So let's get to it.
We are so excited to have you with us today on the show. I think this is a perfect time, though, to jump into our first case. Sean, cool. Do you want to tell us about Mr. A?
Yeah, I'd love to. So Mr. A is a 38-year-old man who has a history of an opioid use disorder. So he was previously on methadone and he was doing really well, but unfortunately could not get to clinic every day. Work really got in the way. And so he eventually stopped going. And in the setting of withdrawal and increased cravings from kind of being off methadone, and injuring his back at work, he started using fentanyl. Started as just kind of buying and using the powder intranasally, and then over time wound up using 10 bags per day intravenously. And he's coming in after feeling like he just can't take it anymore. He's had 5 days of really horrible pleuritic chest pain, fevers, chills, and most recently had the onset of back pain. And when he gets into the ED, he is febrile, he has a leukocytosis of 16, he gets started on antibiotics, and they get a couple of blood cultures. And so I kind of wanted to, I think in the front of everyone's mind here is some kind of injection-related infection, but kind of like the quick version of how do you diagnose endocarditis? What's your like first workup off the bat?
Totally. Great question. Also, I love you said antibiotics and then culture. Hopefully they got the culture the other way around. It's like the ID person, we can't help but start that way. But back to your question. Yeah, diagnosis. You know, I mean, I think that, you know, I have the benefit of knowing the title of this episode. So, like, we know we're in endocarditis territory, but, like, with the script that you described, I'd say the differential is broad, as you alluded to. I'd say, like, my summary of it sounds like relatively young man with opioid use disorder, currently injecting fentanyl, admitted with acute onset, fever, back pain, pleuritic chest pain. And, you know, given that pretty acute tempo and symptom localization in someone who's, you know, regularly pulling bacteria from a non-sterile space to the sterile intravascular space, I'd worry, you know, about bacteremia and then subsequent seeding of anatomic compartments. And in addition to the valves and endocardium, there's the epidural space, the vertebrae, as you mentioned, this Mr. A having had a back injury, there's a pleural space and, you know, any number of other compartments. So ultimately, I think important to do an excellent physical exam, listening for a murmur, pressing along the spine, ranging and palpating his joints, in addition to skin exam, pulmonary exam, abdominal exam. And then, you know, depending on your findings and perhaps initial blood culture results, having a low threshold to get an echo, which, you know, I think to round out that, you know, diagnostics question, I think brings us to Duke's criteria, known, loved, and I don't need to belabor, you know, this very Googleable, up-to-datable criteria, but I think, you know, in brief, we're thinking about these major factors that increase someone's likelihood of having endocarditis, like blood culture is positive with a commonly causative organism like Staph aureus, streps, et cetera, having a valvular vegetation on echo, and then other minor criteria like fever, injecting drugs like Mr. A, having vascular or immunologic phenomena like septic emboli or Osler's nodes, respectively. Though I will say, you know, while like beloved to learn in med school, some of the particularly, I'd say, immunologic phenomena may imply at least like a subacute duration of disease, which may not be as compatible with a endocarditis in someone using drugs commonly due to Staph aureus that may be more acute and more likely to present with a vascular phenomenon like embolic phenomena. So those are, I'd say, broad strokes diagnosis.
That was great. You're just telling me I don't have to look for Roth spots every. I don't even remember what a Roth spot is, to be honest. So it's good that I don't have to look for them.
I know. The other day in clinic, I was like, where might one find an ophthalmoscope? And if I found one, would I remember how to use it? Yeah. I know.
I think it's the eyes you look in with that,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly. But yeah, I mean, I think that like Janeway lesions, Osler's nodes. I'd like look at people's fingers and skin and splinter hemorrhages. You know, you can see, not necessarily super specific, honestly. I think it's worth doing that exam, like looking, but again, not needing to anchor, I think, on some of those less common things. More focusing on, you know, again, fever, positive blood cultures, murmur, known predisposing factor, and embolic phenomenon.
That's great. And for those of you who are fans of the original Curbsiders, we do have another episode on it, 3112, on infective endocarditis. And it takes you through a little bit more, like Duke's criteria, and has a lovely infographic. And I'm curious, though, because we're, you know, we're the Curbsiders addiction medicine, right? So we really like to chat about how to best care for folks with use disorders. How do the rates of, you know, morbidity and mortality compare for individuals who have ingestion drug use, which I will often say as IDU related endocarditis versus non, you know, IDU related endocarditis?
It's a great, great question, Carolyn. And it's an interesting one. There was recently actually a large international set of prospective cohorts that compared clinical features of, I'll use the same, IDU and non-IDU related endocarditis episodes in something like over 8,000 cases, and found what others in this combined ID addiction space, like Kenneth Acker or Elise Wurzel, Asher Schranz, have described, which is that people admitted with injection drug use related endocarditis tend to be younger, with fewer comorbidities than others with endocarditis. And so thinking about mortality morbidity is a little bit apples oranges. You know, what they found in this big study was that 6-month mortality was slightly lower in the IDU endocarditis group. It was like 14%. I'm looking at my notes here, compared to 22% in non-IDU. And the median age of the IDU group was 37 versus 63 in the non-IDU group. And so I think that it's easy to think, and I think my first reaction was at first like, oh, great, smaller numbers in terms of, you know, mortality is lower in this group. But as I just gave my one-liner, I am 37. You know, 14% 6-month mortality for a group of people who have a lot of life left to live, may be more likely to have HIV or hepatitis. But again, like relatively healthy people, like, it's the tragedy. And I think many like to think about this as preventable. So while I think that the numbers or comparison to the non-IDU group mortality may be lower, it again sort of feels really heavy and important to consider and prevent.
Yeah, I think it's like great to have that context of like, yeah, of like these are young, I mean, these are young and healthy people that really shouldn't be dying, 14 out of 100 of them in 6 months. And so like, if we can prevent endocarditis, number one goal, but if not, like, let's treat it correctly and get them through this hospitalization and
totally
and onto evidence-based treatment that we'll talk about later.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it like is a good context or sort of platform to remind ourselves that like people have a lot going on. They may have dependents. They may have other priorities like housing, et cetera. There is like a lot of life left to live. And so it's, and if people are mobile and healthy, et cetera, like they, may be interested in different things. Again, like teaser, we might talk about it later, but not staying in a hospital for 6 weeks, like completing
what?
Their
Nobody
IV.
Nobody wants to sit in the hospital for six weeks.
I know.
And on that note, you know, that's why we're so glad you're here to help us through, like how can we help our patients in this situation? You know, I think there are some additional considerations. So what specific history do you get, you know, from an individual to really assess like specific pathogen risk?
I think many of us, like myself included, went into ID or even medicine because like we love this microbiologic origin story. And, you know, that's how I was taught to like get detailed information about substance use, like in the H&P. And maybe that allows you to guess the pathogen. Like, do you lick your needles and do you also have strep mangonosis? But I think like my hot take is that I don't think this practice is patient-centered or often worth doing in the H&P. So I'd say like my approach to taking a substance use history in someone who has a potential infectious complication of drug use is one, iterative, and two, management-oriented in a way that's hopefully patient-centered. I think an example of this is like, you know, say I'm meeting our patient, Mr. A, at admission, and he's writhing in bed, being uncontrollably anxious, uncomfortable, nauseous, like clearly in opioid withdrawal. That's not the time I would like to ask him, like, whether he licks his needles. This person, you know, will be getting vancomycin empirically, plus minus ceftriaxone. So I don't think we need that pathogen-focused substance use history right off the bat, but rather I think we need a broad strokes understanding of the type of substance he uses, maybe the route, and you know, maybe he's exhibiting a lot or is using a lot of fentanyl with likely high tolerance and has signs of opioid withdrawal. In order to treat him best, you know, today or right now, I'm most interested in maybe what his treatment history was like and what he would like in terms of opioids right now. And then later on days 2, 3, 4, once you've gotten to know someone better and have built some trust and have the space, like, then I love to ask people, you know, walk me through how you typically use, and so we can identify together opportunities to facilitate safer use or prevent a secondary infection. I know a lot of people are already practicing like this, but I think, you know, it's routinely taught to med students or residents in this way. And so I think that, again, just like liberating yourself from like only asking this one really intense set of history questions in the beginning and having it, again, be iterative and management focused is how I'd say I do it.
I love that. I feel like I completely agree. I mean, it sounds like empiric antibiotics are empiric antibiotics for everybody essentially that's coming in like this, and that you got to take your detective hat off for a little bit while a patient looks really, really bad in front of you and just address what they need addressing, right? And so I feel like it is hard to break that mold, I think, sometimes when you're like in such like training mode where you're like, I need to get all the information right now. And you're like, no, like sometimes when I first meet people, it's just like, what are you withdrawing from? What do I need to give you to feel better? I'll be back in a couple hours after you get that and we can talk more.
Totally. Yeah, exactly. And if you can have a great conversation in the beginning, fantastic, like to be able to like sit down and have that entire H&P. But I think that it, in reality, yeah, it's often more complicated or more staccato than that. Empiric antibiotics, like whole, obviously separate talk in of itself, but certainly, you know, your pretest probability for what infection they have informs your choice of empiric antibiotics. But I think that like, rather than necessarily someone's status as someone who uses drugs, I use their clinical stability as like my main sort of factor. In other words, what big a problem is it going to be if I am wrong about my narrow spectrum of activity? And that's like generally how I think about it. So
yeah. I think that's great. And I want to add though, like, and we are nerds and we want to, I'm, you know, just for learning and teaching purposes too, I think as well, sometimes patients, you know, never fully feel comfortable, I think, sharing their practices. And sometimes I do find that, and I get it, right? Like we don't give patients a good reason to trust us. Despite often like a lot of attempts to build rapport, and sometimes it just doesn't quite happen in the way, you know, in this picture book way. And I know I'm making a guess and assumptions, right? But to give some high points of how I would counsel somebody maybe on safer injection practices, here's this bug and maybe they were doing this practice, any framework to think about that, even though we should not be harassing our patients about this directly, but just, you know.
No, I totally agree with you. I think that my approach is like, removing it from necessary, like liberating us from like the H&P history, but thinking about where can I, you know, a couple days into the hospitalization when I'm thinking about like using a harm reduction lens or like how can I prevent this from happening in the future? How can I use that pathogen and have a like conversation? What I end up doing is having someone, you know, walk me through how they use, just like their steps of, you know, one, like how they're preparing their drug to inject, how they're, or if they're cleaning their skin, and then how they're drawing up the drug and injecting it. And if along the way, there is an area in which this is a place where the pathogen I know is at play here is affecting our patient. Like, I think that's a place where I basically share my thoughts if they aren't already worried about it. And then, like, another example of this, I saw a patient with just like a horrible MRSA hardware infection of the leg, was buying clean needles and had actually in the chart, it had been charted multiple times, like using clean needles, but was never cleaning his skin, and had the skin bug. And so we just talked about the importance of cleaning his skin. And again, who knows exactly how effective it'll all be, but I think that it is super helpful and important from a ID perspective. And also I think from a, I don't know about whether you guys have found the same thing, but I feel like it's like really one of my favorite conversations to have with patients, and that like, you're really like aligning and you're on the same team and you're both sharing things and like brainstorming. And anyway, I feel like it's empowering.
Yeah, I agree. I also feel like it's like that, it's often like an unexpected conversation because patients are like, who is this lame ass doctor? When they see me, at least, who is this lame ass doctor? And they're like, oh, wait, you're talking to me about how to use drugs? Yeah. Like, maybe you're a little less lame than I thought. And then I curse a little bit and then we're all friends.
Yeah, exactly. I know. Totally. Totally. They're like, oh, you care. Oh, yeah. Interesting. What? Yeah. Tell me more.
So back to our case, we do get more details. You know, we have managed his withdrawal. We have, sort of hemodynamically stabilized him. And he does tell you he goes to the needle exchange, always uses clean, sterile needles, never shares substance, but he does lick his needles before injection. He states that he does his best to clean his skin. It may not always be perfect, but he says he cleans his skin by just wiping the area off with his shirt. And he is started on short-acting oxycodone to manage his acute back pain and prevent withdrawal. His blood cultures show MSSA, and he is narrow to oxacillin. On CT chest, it actually shows septic emboli. And on his TTE, so his echo, his surface echo, he does have like a 2.4 centimeter vegetation on his tricuspid valve. And his blood cultures, man, now he's on hospital day 4, and they're still growing. So I think my next question for you is, you know, which patients with endocarditis should have cardiothoracic surgery evaluation, and what are some of the indications to consider surgery?
In thinking about how and when to involve CT surgery, I always go back to the guidelines and look at, I feel like I learned something new every time. They sort of stratify it to right-sided and left-sided endocarditis, and then also think about the prosthetic valve, whether or not someone has prosthetic valve endocarditis. But in short of that, or I think what's like what is in my head, my framework for, you know, remembering when I may want to call is like three S's, structure, size, and stickiness. Structure referring to like some structural compromise of the heart or tissue disruption. So like new onset heart failure, heart block, intracardiac abscesses, size of the vegetation on the right, calling CT surgery with the vegetation over 2 centimeters, on the left, over 1 centimeter, and particularly if it's on that anterior leaflet of the mitral valve. And if the vegetation's increasing in size on appropriate therapy, that's another reason to call the surgical, call our surgical colleagues. And then stickiness is sort of my proxy for saying hard to treat with antibiotics or antimicrobials. Candida, actually notoriously sticky and hard to eradicate. Multi-drug resistant gram-negative rods are another indication. Or if you have cultures that are positive a week into treatment on appropriate therapy without an alternative source-controlled source of infection. I think cultures can be positive into, as you're seeing, you know, 3 to 4 days into treatment, as we have this big Goomba sitting in the intravascular space, just sort of like flapping in the breeze. But again, around a week is where we start to think about whether surgical management may be indicated. That is another topic in of itself. What duration should we call this persistent bacteremia, and change our management plan, as sort of each day can confer additional morbidity, mortality. And I guess the last thing I'll say about that is, in general, like those three S's are things I think about as sort of my immediate triggers to think about calling CT surgery, but really important to have a low threshold to ask your CT surgeons for their opinion and input.
I've seen this a lot during residency and as an attending too, less now as an addiction med attending, but there are like some places where CT surgeons will just say, I'm not going to operate because the risk of reinfection, this patient uses substances until they can prove that they're not going to use substances again. I don't want to accept the risk of this operation. Like, how do you approach that, particularly for someone who an operation's indicated for?
Yeah, Sean, that's a really common concern. And I think we are, as medical providers, seeing the just horrible outcomes in patients who aren't getting to receive a surgery and are trying to advocate for them. Surgeons may be seeing complications of in patients who are getting their surgeries and are worried about, the intervention that they're providing. And so I think that the key is really like bringing people together and sharing your experiences. I think multidisciplinary endocarditis teams, a novel set of teams that more and more, I think, medical centers across the country have employed, which is fantastic. I think like Harborview when we were in residency together, and I know like Melissa Weimer at Yale has described this, and Harvard hospitals have a great team. There have been data that show that, you know, the presence of a multidisciplinary endocarditis team can decrease in-hospital mortality. So really, I think just, again, speaks to the value of shared perspectives. And we'll just add a plug for the AHA's IDU endocarditis guidelines have a really nice way of walking through, you know, thinking about surgical candidacy and working in a multidisciplinary fashion, and really having, if you're in that situation in which you feel like you're not able to get an indicated surgery for a patient, it may be that transfer to a center of excellence in which, you know, there are surgeons that have done this more routinely or have access to a multidisciplinary team is helpful.
And if you get a multidisciplinary team, they all have cool names like Meet, or I think the Harvard one is Duet.
Duet.
So yeah. Cool, right?
I know.
But don't be intimidated. You can still do it even if you can't think of a cool
even
name.
Even if you, yeah.
Just steal another already used cool name. They're not copyrighted. True. I think it's okay.
And for our patient, you know, because he does have opioid use disorder. So what options would you present for this patient specifically who is actively having acute pain on short-acting opioids, who currently is not on a medication for opioid use disorder?
Yeah.
And like, why should we encourage hospital initiation of MOUD?
Totally. I think that it sounds like Mr. A was on methadone. I always like start with someone's treatment history and, you know, what they liked about it, what they didn't like, and as a place to, go forth and hopefully find something that's going to be effective for them in the long term that you can get started right away. So I think the things on my list are methadone plus short-acting opioids to address his debt as we're up-titrating methadone and his acute pain. Bup plus short-acting opioids, which may involve a little bit more of a dance, but can be totally done, and short-acting opioids alone. And I think to address Carolyn's like great question at the end there around, you know, do we need to prioritize this in the hospital or why? Like, yes, times 1,000. and I think that like, folks listening are on board with bup and methadone reducing all-cause mortality and overdose deaths by sort of dramatic numbers. Work that I have done in the past looking at, you know, people that leave the hospital amidst their treatment for a Staph aureus infection are more likely to die from overdose than untreated infection has reminded me that we just need to shift our perspective from one that is really like infection centric and rather one that is use disorder and infection or just like whole person centric. I think that like along those lines, just highlight some work that Sim Kimmel and others have done BMC looking at mortality after endocarditis, and again have found that that receipt of a medication for opioid use disorder was associated with reduced mortality in the month that they received it. So again, sort of like highlighting the importance of having that med for OUD on board.
I love it. Got to think of both things, not just the infection, but the underlying cause too, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like you said, not number 12 on the problem list.
Just move it up top.
So Mr. A, so he decides after talking to you and kind of figuring out that he can change around his work schedule, which was his big barrier to methadone before, that methadone worked for him. He really wants to get back on methadone. So we up titrate it through his stay, continue short acting opioids to help with his pain, and other multimodal therapy, of course, and some IV pushes in the post-op period because he does undergo a tricuspid valve surgery and replacement. And so for endocarditis in general, how long is a typical antibiotic course? And I mean, I think like the question that's probably on a lot of people's minds is like, that's kind of the big complication is length, of course. So like, how do we work around that or help with that to make it work for people?
Yeah, totally. How do we create some magic and make it actually 5 days? Yeah, great question. I think, you know, how long is a typical course? It depends on the pathogen and whether it's left or right sided. Again, another instance in which I like always go back to the guidelines, but you can generally expect that someone will need treatment between 4 to 6 weeks from culture clearance. 4 weeks, you know, done in the context of having, you know, certain more easy to kill bacteria like strep friends or right sided vegetation with lower bacterial density is the idea on the right side. But it's, you know, generally prolonged therapy, like you mentioned, given there's disseminated disease and need to penetrate these sort of fibrinous intravascular lesions.
And since we are going to need, you know, prolonged antibiotics, it's so challenging for patients, right? They have jobs, they have childcare needs, they have specific issues with housing, they have pets. Since we are going to need, you know, truly prolonged antibiotics in an ideal world, I should say. So let's say he's willing, he's game to try a couple of different options. Like, what are the different avenues we could consider to try and accomplish a full standard course of treatment?
Totally. Great question. I like think of it as sort of like a matrix of route in which you have IV antibiotics, you have your long acting, also IV, but infusion, and oral. And then setting, you can be at home, an infusion center of some kind, a nursing facility, or the hospital, or some potentially co-located substance use disorder treatment settings, if you're fancy. So I think that, you know, the way that I approach that is really having a shared decision-making encounter conversation with your patient and considering like first, like what's the gold standard for my patient that I would offer my family member, my other patients. And then next, like what are my patient's priorities? And, you know, where do some of these like logistically challenging antibiotic options fit together with that? And then, you know, three, can I offer that gold standard that I was thinking about while limiting the need for a patient-directed discharge? And again, I'll like sort of again highlight the awesome authors who wrote the IDU endocarditis guidelines, and they have a nice sort of flow chart in those guidelines that help all of us caring for patients with IDU-related endocarditis in navigating some of those decisions.
I was totally looking at this that flow chart just before we started. It's amazing. I actually copied and pasted it. So, because I loved it so much. So just, I think for our audience to hear, and we'll be sure to link like some items they say is clearly like patient preference matters a ton, as well as feasibility. You know, there are just a lot of realities of life that we have to sort of consider. Do they have insurance? Is their insurance willing to consider somebody to go home, you know, with a PIC? making sure there's informed consent so the patient really understands, right? If this is not gold standard in particular, like making sure that they really know what they're sort of walking into, as well as the home environments. We have many patients who don't have safe places to live or are living in shelters, as well as transportation. Some folks need follow-up and labs, and is this going to be feasible and safe? Because as you know, like some of our antibiotics can have scary side effects, and they need monitoring. So we'll definitely link that for you. And I'm curious, you know, something that I hear all the time is that patients who inject substances can't go home with PICCs, peripheral catheters. I'm curious on your thoughts about that.
I feel strongly about this one. I mean, like, hell yes, they're an option for people. You know, just like insulin isn't the right treatment option for everyone with diabetes, it's not that, you know, PICCs shouldn't be considered right or wrong for all people who use drugs with an infectious complication. Josh Brokus and I wrote a little like critical review about PICC lines in people who use drugs that highlights a lot of excellent work that other people have done. You know, Suzuki et al. Published this large series of people who inject drugs engaging with outpatient parenteral antibiotic therapy or OPAT, demonstrating success in sort of, I think it was over 800 patients. Laura Finucci and Dan Solomon have done really awesome and innovative work with their teams combining OPAT with buprenorphine. There are a lot of different sort of programs out there, but I think the long story short is people who inject can absolutely do well with a PICC line. It is a matter of addressing, is this the option that they would like, that they feel like fits in best with their life, isn't going to be a trigger or set them back from a use disorder perspective. Like you said, about that prior flow chart that we're all going to like wallpaper our bathrooms with, are the logistical pieces in play that make it work well? You know, can we get it done? If then, yes, like people should absolutely have PICCs, but it may not be the right call for many.
I will say, like, the frustration, and this is both the PICC, I feel like the options are like, well, people get PICCs in the hospital, which I feel like almost nobody should not get a PICC in the hospital if they're here for antibiotics for a long time. But bypassing that question, like going home with antibiotics, and if they can't do that, going to like a nursing facility for antibiotics, I think like one of the things that comes up a lot is like a lot of home infusion companies will just say, we won't take this person because they have an opioid use disorder. And same with nursing facilities. And I think it's worth calling out that is like discrimination, it's technically illegal, it's an Americans with Disabilities Act violation. And while we kind of, I think, often accept it, we should start calling out it and like filing complaints with the Department of Justice and trying to get things changed so people can get the treatment that they need in a way that works for them, instead of this crazy way of keeping people in the hospital for 6 weeks. Like, that's bonkers.
That doesn't work. And then people leave because they're like, I'm in prison. And 100%. And, you know, I'm hopeful that this whole Xing of the X waiver at least removes this variable of like, oh, we don't have a waiver provider at our SNF. Like, we can't continue this, our nursing facility, we can't continue this treatment. And we don't have someone to prescribe. I don't know. I'm hoping at least like that one pillar or argument is knocked out. I don't know. We'll see.
I'm slightly less optimistic.
Fair.
I hope I'm proven wrong. I'm dreaming your dreams too.
I generally just write for 6 weeks of Suboxone. If they're going to facility, I'm like, you know, it's going to be given to them. Right. So that is another thing to consider too, is to provide a lengthier prescription of buprenorphine as well as something you can do in the hospital if that is an argument that folks are trying to
pin down. That's a great point.
And I think just like big summary, it sounds like is nothing is contraindicated, particularly just because someone uses drugs. Like, you should just assess the person in front of you and try to get them the treatment that works for them. And if it's, hopefully you can get the gold standard where they want to do it. And if not, have a conversation about what you can offer where and how to make it work for them.
Exactly. Beautiful summary.
Can you tell us, though, there are some like pretty cool newer antibiotic agents on the market that I have used once or twice. I think Aritavancin and
Dalbavancin. Maybe.
Yes, that's it. Thank you for not making me butcher that word. Can you tell us just a little bit about those, how they work, how they may be helpful in some situations?
So, yes, our new agents that are like lipoglycopeptides that I also have trouble not butchering are really exciting. The way that I think about Dalbavancin, which is the one that I think of with the strongest body of evidence, also what happens to be the one that is sort of on formulary nearest to me at San Francisco General, or for people to remember at home, it's like a long-acting vancomycin. So like using it in scenarios in which a spectrum of activity against, you know, many gram-positive cocci, including MRSA, is excellent. And with two 1,500 milligram doses a week apart, you buy yourself 8 weeks of a therapeutic serum or tissue concentration. So beautiful parts of this include not needing to take a med or multiple doses of a med during the day, or needing to be in a hospital or nursing facility. Downsides include cost. The fact that you do need to locate someone a week later, and there are all the logistics involved there. Half-life's about 2 weeks of a single dose. And then it has not been studied in a randomized control trial yet. There is a trial that's ongoing that is enrolling folks with complicated bacteremia and right-sided endocarditis in step down to Dalbavancin, which will be really interesting. And I think exciting and practice changing, you know, in the years to come. So stay tuned. All part of this conversation around like, are oral antibiotics appropriate? And like, what are our alternatives to like, you know, the 6 weeks of IV?
Yeah. Doc? Let's say our patient decides, you know, he's like, there's no way, doc, I just can't do it. I can't stay for 6 weeks. So I see this all the time too, where people don't opt to prescribe antibiotics or anything. That's like absolutely heartbreaking because I'm like, but like they need treatment. Even if it's not perfect, if somebody has diabetes and doesn't want insulin, we don't say no
metformin.
No med for you. I know. Right. I know. Yeah. I was doing this chart review project around sort of Staph aureus infection outcomes, and same, it like it felt like nails on a chalkboard when I would read, like, you know, left, therefore, like
no antibiotics given.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's like such an strange, odd punishment. And I think that there are really beautiful data that like Laura Marks and crew at WashU have published that answer this question around, like, you know, what if someone is leaving? Is it effective to give them oral step down? And they looked at what happened to people who got nothing after they left their, you know, IV antibiotics in the hospital versus getting oral antibiotics. And maybe not surprisingly, some antibiotics are better than no antibiotics. You're shocking when it comes to, yeah, microbiologic failure or death. So give people their, I think like, actually this highlights a good framework is, you know, if someone is imminently leaving the hospital as happens, despite our best efforts, I think it is imminently clear that trying to get antibiotics in hand or in body as best as you can is exactly what you should do, rather than saying like, sorry, I don't think this is as good, therefore we're not going to do it. Trying to get, again, either Dalbavancin or an oral regimen in body is excellent. I think that when people say, you know, like, wasn't there this, speaking of other cool named things, like, wasn't there this cool poet trial, like, that's now 4+ years ago? Can't we just give everyone orals? Like, why is anyone staying? I think what we need are the right antibiotics for the right reasons. There are a few variables that that influence, you know, how effective certain antibiotics may be for endocarditis. So, you know, we want the right antibiotics that, in addition to having the appropriate spectrum of activity that you like see, you know, on your susceptibility data, we're thinking about bioavailability. So the serum levels are high and tissue penetration is good. Like PK and dosing schedule, and clinical experience with endocarditis. So, you know, like for that patient of mine with serratia bacteremia, with an isolate susceptible to nitrofurantoin, we wouldn't use that drug as the serum levels are non-existent. And so I think right antibiotics, which your friendly ID consultants can help you with, is one thing. And then the right reasons, I think what I mean by that is that there are, you know, a couple different reasons you're giving oral treatment. As we alluded to, with that urgent leaving the hospital, you're sort of in harm reduction mode. The scenario in which you are shared decision-making with your patient, maybe that we are right now with Mr. A and discussing risks and benefits, you know, if your patient is sharing that they're confident in their adherence, they have some outpatient support, like awesome. If they don't think that they, you know, say can take oral meds unsheltered on the street, then like it's not a viable plan to use orals. And I've seen that happen with a patient, just one comes to mind, in which they're having, you know, behavioral issues on the floor. And someone was like, can't we just use orals for this person? And they were like, no, I'm not going to take them. I can't take them. And so it's, I think, important to, yeah, again, just right antibiotics and right reasons.
I want to shout out to every ID consultant in the hospital who has responded to my call. But what if the patient leaves? Are they going to leave? Well, I don't think so, but can you please just give me a backup plan just in case they leave at like 2 a.m. So something's in the note. So like they're set with something and they've been all awesome. They've all been like, yeah. So I think that's a great point too. Like kind of prepare, you know, stuff happens, you know, in patients' lives. So it's good, I think, to be proactive to try and get some like prelim recs just in case. So that way people aren't panicking. There's kind of a plan and it's helpful. I think it's hard at the end, right? When you get that like patient's leaving, now we need to call ID and it's tough. It's tough for the care coordination piece.
Yeah, I know. I totally agree. And I will say, just like being honest, I was guilty of like being just nervous about getting that call and being like, wait, am I acting as a Band-Aid? Or like, do you actually have untreated withdrawal? And like, we should treat your withdrawal. And like, by me giving you the antibiotics, like, is that going to mean that you leave and we should have been treating your withdrawal? And I think that the answer is like, we just need to think about all of it. Like, that it's like a yes and sort of thing where like, yes, give, like have some antibiotics ready to go so that, you know, they can come up from pharmacy and like all the stuff so someone can actually get it in their body. And also think about like, is there anything about our caring environment that we could change to make it more hospitable for someone, recognizing that, again, like competing priorities are real. And also we have no treatments for stimulant use disorder that are sort of super awesome in the hospital. And so, I think that all of the above is important.
Yeah. A big plug for, there's no regulation or rule that you can't give people stuff when they're leaving prematurely, right? Antibiotics, buprenorphine, set them up with methadone. You can even give them opioids if they need them for their pain. Yeah. Like leaving prematurely does not mean we just abandon people. Get their phone number. You can like call them a couple days later and make sure they got all their stuff.
Right? Yeah.
Let's just help the person.
Totally. I used to see a lot more than now, like AWOL on charts. And it's like such an odd military thing where you're like, you're abandoning your post, your duty, you know, and like, this is, it's on you. And I think that goes along with the silo of like the inpatient outpatient space when it's really just like one person dealing with their challenges like across time, and it's not, there is a call of duty to remain in the hospital. Like it's not always easy to figure out how to, you know, traverse inpatient outpatient, but as best we can. Totally agree with that plug times 10.
Well, this has been just a fantastic conversation. I was wondering if you have any like main take-home points for our listeners.
Take-home points. I think that I'd say one is, you know, to make the experience of talking about drugs as patient-centered as possible. Gather your substance use history iteratively and with an eye toward management. Like thinking about like, what am I doing with this information today? Two is, you know, partnering with your consulting teams, and, you know, even better utilizing those multidisciplinary endocarditis teams if they exist, coming up with other fancy acronyms or using existing ones.
I hope to see a lot of new acronyms.
Yeah, exactly.
Sweet, I see your new acronyms.
Totally. And then three is, I think, like just going through this process of, you know, one, asking yourself, like, how can I facilitate my patient receiving gold standard infection treatment, which may involve offering gold standard addiction treatment. You know, is there a way to make this caring environment better for my patient? And then if your patient has competing priorities, consider, you know, what is the most effective antibiotic that will best work and be feasible for this patient? I think those are most of it.
That was an amazing take-home point. I mean, I would be excited to listen to this episode if I hadn't just participated in this episode.
If you hadn't just created it.
Anything else before your two little monsters get home? Anything else you want to plug?
The monsters, like right on time. They just arrived.
I think we're also right on time.
Right, yeah. You just crushed it. We're so used to, and we did this all throughout the episode, we're calling this like injection drug use associated infection, at least in San Francisco anyway. So much smoking is happening. Methamphetamine for a long time, fentanyl now, like primarily smoked here. And while we're still learning all of the ways that these substances interact with our immune system and may lead to infection either via qualitative immunocompromise or behaviors like skin picking, et cetera. I think just that strength of, you know, partnership between addiction medicine and infectious diseases like should hold throughout, whether or not it's injection related, just like care for people who use in the hospital. So that's like one tiny random plug. And then I think my own particular bent, because I see my two, so much untreated stimulant use disorder, is just like thinking about how can we do better for people who use stimulants? Like we have great options for medications for opioid use disorder, which we still need to like do better at implementing and retaining, et cetera. But I think that, yeah, and I've been on a little just like journey through thinking about contingency management in different spaces. And I hope just that like we all are thinking more about that in the next couple of years.
I love that.
Yeah, we'll have to have you back on to tell us about all the cool things you've been working on.
They're in progress. Oh, man. This was so fun, guys. Thank you for having me. And just a wonderful chat feeling.
Yeah.
And we will be back with our lightning round.
Can you please give us a one-liner to describe yourself?
I can. I am a 37-year-old person unbothered by infinite years of medical training. Now a criterion infectious diseases and addiction medicine specialist, mother of two under two, and outdoor enthusiast generally.
Two under two. I'm like dying with one almost over two. No, just over two.
She's like technically just turned two, but I like to still say that because it like, I think like symbolizing, yeah, exactly, like how I feel inside.
I think everybody who does this just deserves an award. Like, congrats.
I'll take it.
If infinite medical training didn't prepare you for this, then, you know, like what will?
So true. I know. Totally. Like the overlap between the two is amazing though. world, like the amount of MI I feel like I use on my toddler is strong.
I read a book about like how to talk to your kids, and it was just a book on MI that they just reframed as how to talk. So I was like, oh, I kind of know this. This is great.
Yeah, exactly. No, we haven't moved on yet to complex reflection, but you know, it's true.
I always like to kind of hear a little bit about how everybody got to addiction med, because I feel like it's something that doesn't come up so often in medical school and even residency, although I know in our residency it came up a little bit. But
yeah, totally. I came to addiction medicine via ID. I had always been interested in social determinants of health and just how someone's narrative and story played a role in the, in their health and health outcomes. And then, you know, I think it was like Sean and I were in residence together, but it's like, yeah, my R2, R3 year when I was honing in on ID, I was thinking about just so many cases of drug-related infections in which the antibiotics were the band-aid and we were sort of ineffectively addressing the root cause, the use disorder. And I, you know, end of my R3 year, just prior to starting my chief year, went to BMC's chief resident immersion training in addiction medicine, and just had the like just an amazing opportunity to be immersed in it and spend a lot of time with people with lived experience. And yeah, just I started, I think that was like the initial bug of like, I want to spend my time here. And then my, after first year of ID fellowship, I really felt like if I really want to focus on like how to think of more patient-centered, more effective ways to take care of people like as a whole with infections and use disorders, I need to do training in both of them. So I tacked on my addiction medicine fellowship. I kind of like sandwiched it in or like shoved it in between my years of ID. And so that's how I ended up doing, doing both. And I'm just so glad I did, because addiction med's the best.
Holla, definitely yeah. Agree.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I think it's so cool that many specialties can come into the field of addiction medicine. You know, it's nice to hear specialists getting excited as well to treat this.
Definitely. It's been fun to just, you know how, I mean, every little field, like both medicine from, you know, surgery or, and then addiction medicine compared to other specialties have their own like flavor and culture and way about it. And so it's been also just fun to compare disciplines a little bit. Like I feel like in addiction med, at least like our patients, like no one like judges me for my use of expletives, or like people are just so like real. And so it's just so, the patients are always phenomenal. But just that like degree of realness I appreciate in our field.
I'm addiction glad you medicine. Are. Come for the expletive, stay for the people. So.
Yeah, exactly.
This has been another episode of the Curbsiders miniseries, The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine. And guess what? You can get incredible show notes at thecurbsiders.com/addiction.
So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts or contact us at curbsidersaddictionmed@gmail.com. A special thanks to Dr. Matt Watto and Paul Williams for their support, as well as ACAM, the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine. Learn more at acam.org. And just remember, whether you're an addiction med physician preparing for the board exam or a physician in practice looking to learn more about addiction medicine, which is amazing. I love addiction medicine. ACAM offers several self-study products that are ready to meet your needs. The bundle includes 86 self-assessment modules that provide CME, as well as 46 didactic lecture recordings. And their board prep bottle offers access to the didactic recordings and offerings. Check out their website again,
which is acam.org. And a reminder that this and pretty much most of our episodes are available for free CME credit for healthcare professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account. And until next time, I've been Dr. Carolyn Chan.